Hello and welcome to Ag PhD Radio, broadcasting from the Morton Studio today. I'm Darren Hefty. We'll be taking your calls and questions all throughout the show today at 844-44-AG-PHD. If you've got an agronomic question you've been thinking about this winter, you know, crops are starting to go in certain parts of the country, and I love it. I love it. When corn starts to go on the ground in the south, and I've got a friend that's all excited about getting corn in the ground, just gets me antsy. And I realize we're still probably 3 months away up here, but man, that's just fun to see things starting to move, especially when all the focus has been on things that we can't control, like tariffs and trade issues and so forth. We don't have a whole lot of power in those things, but as far as input decisions for our crops, we certainly do. Just got back from the Phoenix area. We were down in Gilbert, Arizona yesterday doing a workshop, and it was really fun talking to farmers all around the country. There were people there from Canada and people there from many states in the United States, and I believe there were even a couple that were from Mexico that were there, and lots of different questions, lots of different crops. One of the big things, though, that everyone was interested in, and it's kind of the same story, and it was fun to compare notes a little bit, is just soil fertility issues. And we were talking through some potassium issues with a grower from the northern part of the United States, and then the guys from Arizona jumped into the conversation, and it was fun because everybody's got different situations. Like, for example, in flood irrigation, how are you going to manage things versus in a no-till situation in the north versus center pivot irrigation in the Midwest? And it was kind of fun to hear some of the strategies that farmers were using. For the most part, I would say, they were all basing things around a dry program to build, but there are quite a few that were using some low salt liquid type potassium right along the row in various crops. And I don't even remember all the crops we were talking about that were being grown in the south, but many of those guys were doing the same things that the corn and soybean farmers further north were doing with potassium, putting it near the row and trying to have a relatively safe source of K, and noting that they're getting a lot of K into the plant that way, even in situations where they've got pH challenges or some tie-up issues out in their soil where they just don't have great availability. One of the conversations the corn and soybean farmers were talking about is just simply the difference between corn and soybeans in terms of how many pounds of potassium they're pulling out of the ground per acre per day. And I thought this was interesting. We had brought up the way we were taught potassium uptake worked is that we needed to see at least 5.75 pounds of potassium per acre per day in just a 50 or 60 bushel soybean environment. Not even talking about the guys that are pulling 100 bushels or more for soybeans, but wow, if you're talking about nearly 6 pounds per acre per day you got to pull out, that's quite a bit. And in corn, you only need a little over 3 for 200 bushel corn. You've got a long time that corn is gathering K throughout the season. And we were just talking about how, wow, those soybeans are trying to fill those pods in such a short period of time. We're seeing a lot of growers looking at what can I do to deliver potassium late season in soybeans. Now, in corn, there's a lot of talk about Y drops and other methods that are being used there. The same thing's happening in soybeans. There just aren't as many guys on that bandwagon yet. And it was interesting at the Ag PhD Field Day this year, we had a number of different soybean producers from around the country competing, trying to see who could turn around our ground the fastest and get high yields. I think the lowest yield out of any of those guys in our plots was 92 bushels. So it was pretty good. There's some pretty exciting stuff going on. And that is one of the concepts that several of the guys were doing, is basically Y-dropping some potassium right along the soybean rows in 30-inch rows or in twin rows in some cases. So trying some different row spacings and some of the same strategies that corn growers are doing trying to deliver that K. So we'll see as we get to this year's field day what other ideas people come up with. And also as we're taking your calls and questions from around the country, just chat a little bit about, well, how are you accomplishing these goals? Because for many of the growers there, we were talking to a grower from up in the Green Bay, Wisconsin area. And he was saying, look, I need to get my K built up, but I've got really light soils. And then we had a farmer that farms up in North Dakota in very heavy soils. And he was just looking at, wow, if I'm going to get 4% base saturation K or more, it's going to be a lot of pounds to get that out there. Is it possible? And we got into the discussion, which we like talking about here on the show because it always generates some interest and some discussion, where we put 1,400 pounds of potash out on some ground just for an experiment. We split a 50-acre field and did about half of the field with 1,400 pounds of K in one shot. It really looked like a pink gravel road out there. There's so much potash. But it really did work, and we really did boost our potassium-based saturation, and our crops have looked pretty good since. Now, where we did that trial, we do have a drainage issue, too. We need to get some drain tile installed, but we've got a railroad that runs right along the side of the field. Between the field and the river is a railroad, and getting permission to bore under the railroad is pretty tough sometimes. So that's one other thing that really needs to happen. That would be our first solution to fixing that field. But in the meantime, we're trying to do what we can to raise the best crop that we can. And building up potassium levels there was really important and has definitely changed the appearance of crops and the yield and the profitability as well. Well, on today's show, we're going to be taking your calls and questions throughout the show. Our phone lines are open at 844-44-AG-PHD. We're also on Twitter. You can find us at AgPhD Media, or you can find me at Darren Hefty and see what's going on there. Or you can certainly send us an email, too. We're going to get into the radio email box here in a little bit. That's radio@agphd.com. We've gotten a number of soil samples in and some questions around, hey, if I send you a soil sample, will you take a look at it? The answer is yes, absolutely we will. We do like to see complete soil samples, though, if at all possible, with micronutrients and base saturation and a number of different readings. So if you've got questions on that, you can certainly let us know what you're thinking. We generally use the Midwest SC3 test and base off of that. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this.
One year it could be moisture stress, another Pythium or nematodes. So you need your soybeans to rise ready for whatever the season holds. Now one simple decision provides coverage on four fronts. The Acceleron portfolio, fungicides, insecticides, bioenhancers, and an industry-leading nematicide that strikes where nematodes attack. This season, rise stronger with Acceleron seed treatment products. Learn more at AcceleronSAS.com/riseready. Performance may vary. It's important to use proper PPE when handling treated seed.
Hey, Bill, any advice to control tough weeds and rootworms?
That's easy, Jim. Buy two, save three.
Wait, for weeds and rootworms?
Buy two, save three. Combine your Impact or new Impact Z herbicide purchase with a qualifying insecticide and save $3 per acre.
Buy two, save three. That is good advice.
For details, go to buy2save3.com. Impact, Impact Z, and Buy Two Save Three are trademarks owned by Amvac Chemical Corporation. All rights reserved. Impact Z is a restricted-use pesticide. Always read and follow label instructions.
Want to cut production costs without losing yield? The Soil Warrior can reduce trips across the field, optimize nutrient placement, and improve soil health. So you can lower production costs without losing yield. See what makes the Soil Warrior different and better at SoilWarrior.com.
Tired of that old warped poly boom ruining your spray applications? Express Boom from Hypro is a fully assembled stainless steel boom that ensures an even application of chemicals every time. Don't wait another season. Upgrade today. Hypro, helping you spray better.
Are you frustrated with white mold showing up year after year in your soybeans? If you have tried fungicide applications and are still losing yield to white mold, now is the time to ask your seed dealer about Heads Up Plant Protectant. Heads Up is the first EPA-registered seed treatment for the prevention of white mold in soybeans and pulse crops. The first line of defense on your farm against white mold, now, starts with the right seed treatment package. Locate a Heads Up dealer near you by visiting headsupst.com today.
You're listening to Ag PhD Radio, broadcasting from the Morton Studio today. We're just down in Arizona yesterday. We had a workshop there with 101 ways to cut farm expenses. And we get a lot of questions about, hey, where are you guys going to be at? Where are you going to be speaking? Where are you doing workshops? Our whole list is at agphd.com. Just click on the events tab and find an event. Hopefully not too terribly far away from you. Otherwise, you can certainly come and visit us here. We have events right at our farm. We've got a facility there that accommodates quite a few people, and we really love welcoming people here. A lot of times we'll have two-day events. You can look on our schedule and see there'll be some two-day events where we'll have a meeting 2 days in a row, so you can come in a little bit late the one day, catch a meeting, catch another meeting the next morning, and get out the next afternoon. We're just a few miles away from the airport here in Sioux Falls. If that works out for you, we'd love to see you here later this winter. You know, one of the things at our workshops, too, is we often have Grain PhD at the workshops to take questions. There's a lot of questions as things are happening, especially this year when you think about all the stuff going on with China right now. I've got Scott Harms with us right now. Scott, thank you. We really appreciate having you on the show today, and thanks for being at some of the workshops as well.
Yeah, glad to be here, and it's always great getting out and talking to some of the, you know, some of your followers and answer some of their questions.
You know, there doesn't seem to be a lot of movement here on this China situation or the government shutdown. So what do you attribute the choppiness that we've seen in the markets, and do you expect that to continue?
Yeah, that's kind of what we're dealing with now. And, you know, today was a perfect example of how frustrating this can be in these market environments right now. You know, we had a nice rally to end of the week last week in both corn and soybeans. As you know, some optimism came out regarding the China trade deals, and then over the weekend there was a proposal to reopen the government. But and we had mostly a steady trade today because no one knew where the next move was, and then the rug got pulled out midday or late in the session as there was a service from one wire service reported that the talks were the Chinese and the U.S. government canceled some trade talks, face-to-face talks with China that was going to be a precursor to the events at the end of the month where the high-level talks were going to take place. And then so the market just reacted with lower prices just like that. And then a story came out just as quickly saying that they are going to talk. They're just not going to talk face-to-face. They're going to meet over the phone. So, you know, this is an environment where there's a react first and then sort out the details afterwards. And so we saw pressure to prices, and but it just didn't come back. So, you know, this is the environment we're in right now. You know, it's, you know, the kind of things that farmers really need to avoid, you know, this kind of day-to-day noise. You know, it serves no purpose to be chasing these news stories right now. You know, especially as a farmer, you're supposed to be focused on the longer term. So eventually traditional fundamentals will get back to driving these markets. You know, right now we're going tweet to tweet, minute to minute, breaking news stories. That's what's grabbing the attention. But that's going to change hopefully sooner than later, and we'll get back to trading more traditional supply and demand factors. And, you know, that's where the farmers need to have their focus. And when it comes to the corn market, you know, the outlook could be really, you know, pretty favorable.
Well, I was just reading an article about that, and they said there's a 30% chance we could have 550 corn. I know, I'm quite bullish, so I'm always jumping on things like that. What do you think about that? It seems pretty optimistic.
Yeah, that's a headline-grabbing comment, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
yeah, I read the article. I saw that article as well, and, you know, that's what writers do is they you know, try to grab you with the headline. And, you know, that was a comment. The analyst that made that comment, you know, is someone I've known and worked with for a long time and you know, does some real good work. And I think he was speaking at a farmer meeting. And so the article came out of just comments he made. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that analysts do. They take a look at the historicals and then they project forward where they think prices can go. And, you know, his comments are they're not based on current fundamentals or summer weather issues. It's really just based on charts and history. And so, you know, it's an important part of any marketing strategy to determine what the market is capable of so you can identify how you're going to scale into your sales at reasonable numbers. The 550 target is, you know, for the most part, it should be ignored when you're trying to make a plan, largely because if we're going to see 550 corn, there's probably something really bad going on, either in your farm or your neighbor's farm or a couple states over. So you don't know how it's going to affect you. So you're going to have to probably have to adjust your plan if we were going that high anyways. So I don't think that should be part of the thing to focus on. But he also made a comment that he thought there would be an 83% chance that we would get to 425 basis D score. Now, that's a number you can work with. You can put that and work that into your plan. The bottom line is corn fundamentals are solid. You know, they're actually almost outright bullish, in my opinion, if the right things happen. Initially, you know, we get a trade deal done with China, it's going to include some newfound corn demand and ethanol and DDGs. So, you know, assuming good weather in China, they're running about a 26.5 million ton trade deficit, or, you know, over there, production deficit. So, and that's almost a billion bushels. So, or a little over a billion bushels. So corn stocks in the U.S. are going down. And that number, we would have seen that number a week and a half ago if the USDA would have released their report. So if corn acres are only go up 2 to 3 million acres, and that's what people are expecting them to go up this year, you know, and if we get a trend yield below, just slightly below trend, all of a sudden you got to carry over an estimate around a billion bushels. And that's going to give us our tightest stocks-to-use ratio since, you know, the 2012 drought period. So that's the kind of information that farmers can use in making their plan. You know, don't get so buoyed down with some analysts out there telling you corn can't go up. You know, be optimistic in your initial, when you write your initial plan, be optimistic. You could always adjust as time goes on. And so if your top number, you know, you may have to give way on your top number, and by, say, May 15th, if you haven't gotten anything priced, you start to give ground a little bit. But at least when you initially sit down, when you write a plan, take this kind of information into play and make your plans accordingly.
You know, a lot of the farmers I've been talking to this winter really do believe there is some upside potential in these markets. And honestly, as a farmer, you kind of have to, because if you say, oh boy, it doesn't look good, it's not very much fun to farm, and it's hard to stay positive. So I think a lot of guys have adopted, hey, there is upside potential, and really the facts will back that up. So how do you get a plan in place if you are a little optimistic and you think, you know, I think it is going to get better realistically here, so how can I make money on it?
Yeah, I think in these initial stages, I've been using the phrase scripting your plays. You know, it's something that, you know, it's a football reference, makes sense this time of year. You know, the great Bill Walsh was the head coach of the 49ers. He started it in the 80s of scripting the first 10 to 15 plays of a football game. And so they can get a focus, get everybody focused on the game plan and what we're doing. And I think you could do the same thing in marketing. You know, there's still so many unknowns for farmers at this stage when it relates to cost and what acreage mix they're going to go with. So as much as we believe getting a solid handle on all that information is critical for a marketing plan, plugging that into your GreenBridge software, that's vital as part of, you know, the overall plan moving forward. You also can't let that be a barrier for getting things started, because some of the early opportunities, you know, the opportunities that we see early in the year may be some of the best we're going to see for a while, and you're going to be much more comfortable if you make some decisions early, get something in place. Then you don't have to worry about chasing the market lower if things, you know, the conditions improve. You know, we get a positive end to the trade issues, and the government shutdown. You know, I think we're going to see these markets bounce a little bit, mainly because we're going to be more free to move on the upside, especially as it relates to corn. So got to be ready, and you don't have to have a full plan. Just identify some targets and get some orders working. We run a program. We've identified around 416.5 in D's corn and 984.5 or so in November beans, and that's where we want to advance sales. So we use futures, but, you know, if you, you know, just get a, you know, call your merchandiser, take, you know, these prices minus the basis, and get an order in place. You could also work with a risk manager and identify an option strategy that would trigger if it hit these levels. I mean, there's nothing magical about these levels or numbers we're using, but do something, pick a target and do something. And if you get some action orders in place, all of a sudden you've written yourself a marketing plan.
Yeah, if you've got some offers, if you have some offers out there on a cash bid as well, you could do the same type of thing. And, you know, I know we talked a lot about farmers. We'll have to talk about this another time as we're running out of time here, Scott. But there's a lot of guys that talk to me and say, I'm not comfortable using futures or options yet. How do I get started? And chatted with a farmer down in Arizona this week that said, well, I just got two contracts. It's a very small part of my farm, but at least I'm learning a little bit how to use them. Scott Harms with Grain PhD. Thanks for being on, Scott. We'll be right back after this.
No secrets here. We all know, regardless of the markets, balanced crop nutrition pays. Agro-liquid fertilizers have the research, technology, and products you need to grow a great crop. We also have an outstanding team of field agronomists ready to help you determine the best use of your fertilizer dollar. Agro-liquid can help you maximize your yield potential effectively and economically. Visit agroliquid.com to find a dealer near you.
In order to be the best farmer you can be, you've got to have a grain marketing plan. But what do you do when you're too busy out in the fields trying to maximize yield? Hi, I'm Darren Hefty. My brother Brian and I are always busy learning more about how to make our farm more successful. That's why we use Grain PhD to learn more about grain marketing and to work with our Grain PhD risk expert to create a complete grain marketing strategy. Visit grainphd.com to learn more about a free consultation for your operation.
In farming, getting things done early has a way of setting you up for success. Like using Corvus for an early season win over weeds. Corvus keeps even the toughest weeds from gaining a foothold. Multiple sites of action deliver superior control of emerged weeds. And later, Corvus reactivates with just a half inch of rain to take out any new weeds that may have sprouted. So get an early season win against weeds with Corvus for end of season rewards. Always read and follow label instructions. Corvus is a restricted use pesticide.
Want to turn smart agronomics into smart economics? Go with the all-new Grow Smart Rewards program. 1. Start with a smart agronomic plan. 2. Qualify with the purchase of a participating BASF herbicide. 3. Earn $1+ per acre for each qualifying pair-up brand. Plus, you may qualify for an additional $75 per gallon back on our industry-leading fungicides. For full program details, go to growsmartrewards.com. Grow smart with BASF.
When you build with Morton Buildings, you build something that lasts. And now you can build for less during Building Value Days. If you're dreaming of a personal storage building, horse barn, farm storage, home, office, insulated workshop, or even a commercial facility, take advantage of our discounted pricing on new buildings now through February 28, 2019. So don't delay. Visit MortonBuildings.com for more information.
For over a year, I've been butchering the scripts for the Farmer's Edge ads on my podcast. But hey, it's not my fault. Honestly, they offer too much stuff. On-farm weather stations, that little plastic data transfer thingy they shove in your tractor's port, daily satellite imagery, their integrated farm management software, soil sampling, variable rate technology, it goes on and on and on. And they expect me to do that in one ad. That's why I just say Farmer's Edge. It's a company developed by an agronomist to help make you a better farmer.
Hey everybody, come on in. The Ag PhD mailbag is about to begin.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio, broadcasting from the Morton Studio today. Our phone lines are open all throughout the show. We're going to be answering some of the many questions we've been getting in here over the last few weeks. We've got a few that we haven't gotten to that they're starting to get a little age to them now, and we need to get into those quick as we can. Also, whenever we start doing workshops, we generate a lot of questions as well, usually. If you have a question for us or a soil test you'd like us to take a look at, you can give us a call at 844-44-AG-PHD or send us an email, radio@agphd.com. I'll start off with one from Brad, and Brad is from Wisconsin. He said, I'm following up on a comment you guys had made about using liquid in-furrow pop-up starter on corn. Now, I heard somebody that you were talking to discuss putting on a dry blend where they had a 9-23-30. They're putting 250 pounds out with the planter and then planting around the 1st of May. And they asked if they should also use an in-furrow pop-up, and you thought it might not be economical. I guess I'm curious because I'm thinking of adding a liquid setup in addition to the dry, and now I'm wondering if I should do that. Can you discuss this further, or did I just hear you wrong? Well, Brad, thanks for the question. Personally, if I could have a 2x2 on both sides of the row and in-furrow application equipment, man, I'd be all over that. Now I've got three different places I'm putting stuff, and we're hearing a lot of the high-yield farmers, especially on lighter soils, seeing pretty nice benefits with that 2x2 on each side of the row. Randy Dowdy has certainly been talking about this, but there are plenty of other guys. Kevin Matthews in North Carolina, he talks about this a lot. And at our Ag PhD field day last year, Glenn Herz, our research lead, he had a 2x2 on each side, and it was pretty interesting what we were seeing even on our soils. So that's something that I'm really interested in. Now, you may not be able to do that, or it may not be easy for you to do that on your planter, but something to consider. So I guess your 2x2, I'm assuming it's just on one side. So I would say that would be something you could do too, or consider anyway, as maybe you want a 2x2 on the other side of the row also. Now, talking about the in-furrow, in terms of fertilizer, the majority of the farmers that we talked to at the Ag PhD field day, guys that had plots in our field day and other farmers that were speaking, said they're really trying to get away from a lot of the in-furrow because what they've seen is too many guys doing 1034-0 at high rates. We've had good luck with our agri-liquid program. We haven't seen that hurt our germination or hurt our young root systems. So I think it may come down to product selection as well, if you want to put something in furrow or not. And certainly there are some good products that can go in furrow. I guess the real thing on this question, though, is if I'm already putting 250 pounds of fertilizer in a 2x2, should I be putting any more on in furrow? And probably the answer is no. Depending on exactly what you got with that fertilizer, and I'm not familiar with that particular blend, haven't worked with it, but you're starting to get quite a bit of salt in really close proximity to the seed. So I would say, I don't know, unless you're in a super deficient situation out there, I don't know that adding a whole lot in the furrow would gain you much. However, you might add a small amount. Maybe you want to add 1 to 3 gallons in there, something like that. Or here's what we're doing. If you're moving stuff over in a 2x2 or in a 2x2 on each side of the row, maybe you want to use that in-furrow application for some of the microbial products that you're using or humates and that kind of thing. There's a lot of different choices, and I think as we go forward in agriculture, we're going to want to have as many options as possible to deliver these things, because if you're putting fungicide out and you're putting a microbial that has a bunch of fungal species in it, kind of makes sense for me to have a little distance between the two. Well, Brad, I don't know if that helps you or not. I would still go ahead and put that liquid system on, but I don't know. I would do some testing on it to see if you're doing a similar dry program in a 2x2, if you're going to still see big gains with that, or maybe you'll see more gains using microbial products or something else. Thanks for the question. Really appreciate that. I got one from Myron here, and he said, I just wanted to comment. You were talking about harvest loss in corn, and I still think the best way to recover that harvest loss is to let the cows clean it up after the combine. I get it, Myron. That's exactly what a lot of farmers would do in that situation if they had livestock. But the way I look at it, I'd rather get all that corn into my combine and then be able to feed corn to the cattle. But that's just me. But thanks for the comment, Myron, and thanks for watching the show or listening to the show. Really appreciate that. Got a question from Zach in Southeast Minnesota. He said, I attended your 101 Ways to Cut Farm Expenses workshop at Rochester. Had a great time and learned a lot in a short period of time. My question is, we're currently applying our dairy manure with a sweep at about 6 to 8 inches deep. Would it be an advantage to go to a Coulter style that would inject more of the dairy manure in the 1 to 6 inch zone? The Coulter's a lot less soil disturbance, which is pretty cool. Possibly would open a door for us to no-till. Now, I see on all of the corn plots in the booklet that you handed out that there were some 8,000 gallon per acre applications. I'm just wondering what method of injection you use. Thanks. Hey, Zach, we're doing things similar to what you're doing with a sweep at about 6 or 8 inches deep. And ideally, we'd like to go even deeper. What we're seeing across the country is that most of the fertilizer that farmers have in soil is in the top few inches of soil. And I would say in the top 6 inches for sure, but even more than that, in the top 3 inches. If we could put our manure deeper, we can really do some good things with it. When you look at a lot of the world record corn growers and yield champs over the last couple of generations, one thing in common that you'll find is many of them have built their lower soil profile. So not just the top 6 inches, but they're trying to get the top, well, probably 2 feet to look very similar on a soil test. So building up levels of all those nutrients down to a depth of 2 feet or even more. I know I was at Francis Child's farm back in 2002, and he had root pits dug down to 5 feet, and you could see some differences, and you could see some impacts on root growth down several feet in the soil. It was really impressive what he had done over a long period of time. With your asset that you've got, dairy manure, you could do some pretty interesting things, especially in some of that really nice soil that you've got in Southeast Minnesota. I know it's not every field's perfect, but you've got some pretty nice soil to work with. I would try to build that deeper. So if it's me, I'm not going to use the coulter and do it shallow. I'm going to use the sweep and do it deeper. Or better yet, if I had some sort of shank that I could get it down even deeper in the soil, that's what I would do. We did, just to give you an example, we used a four-row Brilliant Zone Commander back, 15 years ago probably. We don't have manure application equipment, and so the person we were working with to apply manure on our farm, we asked him if he would hook up onto that Zone Commander and just see what would happen. But what we found out quickly is he didn't have enough tractor to pull it, but he was going down 20 inches deep. And where we were in a situation where we're relatively flat, so he could pull it at a decent clip, we were putting manure all the way down 20 inches in those slots every 30 inches out in our field. And what we saw a couple of years later is down through our yellow clay subsoil, now we had black stripes every 30 inches. That was pretty interesting for us to see. And I wish we had our own application equipment and could do that. But we don't. So yeah, if you had the option of doing that, going deeper in the soil profile, that would be my first choice. And that'd also give you a lot more cushion when it comes to rates. You mentioned the 8,000 gallon per acre rate, and that's what got applied on some plots that we had on our farm. But, once you start getting a little higher rate, especially in lower CEC soils, that could be an issue where you could see some injury and that type of thing. So just want to be really cautious. If you're spreading it out over more of the soil profile, gives you a lot more forgiveness in terms of how much salt is going to be there, and also sets you up for deeper roots that are able to extract nutrients even when it starts drying out in the summer. Hey, Zach, thanks for coming to our workshop, and thanks for your kind words about that. We really appreciate that. And thanks for your question today, too. Taking your calls and questions all throughout the show on today's Ag PhD radio program. Our phone lines are open at 844-44-AG-PHD. You can also find us on Twitter, Ag PhD Media, or Darren Hefty, or just send us an email, radio@agphd.com. Get back to more of those emails coming up right after this.
Your grain bin fans can cost you a lot. High electric bills from running when conditions are not ideal, shrinkage from overdried grain, and spoiled grain all take money out of your pocket. With the Steps GMS app temperature humidity switch, get your bin fans to start making you money. Only run vans when the conditions are right. Eliminate shrink and spoilage in your bins. Deliver grain in top condition at market moisture. When every dollar counts, you need Steps GMS. Contact us today at stepsgms.com. What do you think of when you hear Palmer Amaranth or water hemp? If you use Fierce herbicide in your soybean field, you don't have to think about them at all. With two effective modes of action and up to 8 weeks of residual control, Fierce takes on even the toughest weeds like water hemp and Palmer Amaranth. Take control of your soybean field and get rewarded with Roundup Ready Plus when you choose the proven power of Fierce herbicide. Talk to your local retailer today to put Fierce to work in your fields. Always read and follow label directions.
Clean fields and higher yields start with a strong battle plan. For soybean growers, there's no stronger ally than Sonic herbicide. When applied pre-emerge, Sonic has proven to defeat yield robbers like water hemp, mare's tail, and giant ragweed. With long-lasting residual control, it keeps fighting to defend your field from invaders. Visit battleweeds.com to plan your attack against weeds. Always read and follow label directions.
Sir, yes, sir!
Your independent spirit is more rewarding than ever before. Unlike incentive programs that require growers to purchase a particular seed brand or to bundle certain products, the FMC Freedom Pass program rewards you for making the best choices for your fields. You decide what's best for your operation, from pre-plant to harvest. Your retailer and FMC take care of the rest. It's really that simple. The exclusive agronomic rewards, performance assurances, application innovations, and product financing of the FMC Freedom Pass program make it easier to protect your crops and cash flow. That's what we mean when we say we give you more freedom in the field. You'll experience more control and confidence, too. Generics and imitators can't promise that. Visit your authorized FMC retailer or FMCFreedomPass.com to calculate your potential financial incentive and learn more.
High-yield corn growers know that feeding the crop and soil are keys to maximizing yield potential. Nutec's EDA and Reverb are specifically formulated to help manage limiting factors associated with today's farming conditions. Nutec's EDA works within the plant to support nutrient mobility and utilization. Reverb focuses on the soil, providing beneficial trace elements which help condition the root zone for optimal microbial activity. Low use rates and superb tank mix compatibility make Nutec's EDA and Reverb no-brainers in the high-yield grower toolbox.
Listening to Ag PhD Radio, broadcasting from the Morton studio today. We're taking your calls and questions all throughout the show at 844-44-AG-PHD. Also, taking your emails, radio at agphd.com. I got one here from Jonathan, and he said he's from western Minnesota, about where the two Dakotas meet the Minnesota border. And he says, I've got a quick question regarding elemental sulfur and pH. I'll give you some background. We purchased a quarter of land about 5 years ago, and we did 5-acre grid sampling when we bought it. Most of the grids came back with a pH in the 7.8 to 8.2 range. We did have one sample that tested at 8.6. However, that seems to be a bit of an anomaly. Also, CECs were in the low 20s, so it's fairly heavy soil. We tiled the quarter 2 years ago, and it's helped immensely. The next goal is to correct the soil pH. My questions are these. First of all, which size grid soil test would you like to see prior to spreading elemental sulfur? All right, I'll start with that one, Jonathan. So good job getting the tile in there. And I'm sure in a high pH situation in western Minnesota, oftentimes what we're dealing with in dry land farming is we've got an issue with drainage over time and the pH has gone up. Talking to farmers in the Red River Valley, the border of North Dakota and Minnesota, a lot of the pHs back 40 years ago were down in the low sevens, and now we see many of them up in the eights. So it's taken, you know, a generation to get them that high. Your question today is, how do I make it a lot faster than a generation to get them back down where they need to be so they're not limiting our yield and our nutrient uptake and our microbial survival and so forth? What we've done on our farm where we're dealing with pH issues and trying to get things fixed, we've gone as low as 1-acre grids. I get it. That's kind of cost prohibitive for a lot of guys. But if you know, in general, the entire field is at least a 7-8, you don't have anything less than a 7-8, what you could do is you could even just go out and say, all right, I'm just going to put elemental sulfur out like it's a 7-8 all across the board. And then wait a year or so and see where you're at. You've got good drainage, so elemental sulfur could be effective for you. If you didn't have your drainage done yet, I would encourage you to get the drainage done first and get the elemental sulfur later, because it just doesn't work well if you don't have good drainage underneath to get the bad things to flush out and so forth. So let's just start with that. The grid soil test, it's up to you how you want to do it. If the entire field is high pH, you could just start running with some elemental sulfur out there and target it for the 7-8, and then come back a second time and deal with some of the higher pH spots. Or if it was our farm, we would grid size as small as you are comfortable doing. 1 acre would be awesome just to know where you're at. But if you don't think there's really that much variance and you really don't think there's anything that's less than a 7-8, then maybe a 2.5 or a 5-acre grid would be fine. Okay, how do I find an agronomist that's qualified to write rates, or what rate do you use? Well, on our farm this fall, we did some variable rate elemental sulfur across the farm. We started at about a 6.8 pH, and each 1/10 of a point of pH up, we tried 15 pounds of elemental sulfur. So, for example, say we were at a 7.7, and we said, okay, that's 10 tenths of a point up. Well, we would go with 150 pounds. Now, we also tried some at 25 pounds per 1/10 of a point of pH going up from 6.8. So we would do 250 pounds at a 7.7 pH. So we're trying a couple different rates to see, because here's the problem. We've seen data from multiple universities. I know Clemson's got a chart for elemental sulfur rates, and we saw another chart from Ohio State, and there are other universities as well that have looked at this, and they've had different results than we've had. And I get it. They've got different weather and different soils in those states than what we've got or we farm in South Dakota. But I think it's one of those things. There just hasn't been enough testing, and I don't know that anybody's got a really good gauge in terms of, well, my pH is here, my cation exchange capacity is here, my annual rainfall is there, whatever factors you can put together. I don't know that I've got a good rating scale for you. I can just tell you what we've done, which is 15 to 25 pounds per each 1/10 of a point of pH. We are above 6.8. So you can try whatever you want on your farm. We've done some crazy, like for example, David Huell has been raising some corn on our farm for a number of years and actually doing fantastic, especially managing it from the opposite side of the country. But he put out 1,000 pounds elemental sulfur just in a plot, just to see how far things would move. And, you know, this is something that we see a lot of the really successful growers doing, just saying, look, I'm going to take a small amount of acres, something that is not going to break me, even if I killed the crop. But he just wanted to see what would it take to move the needle. So he put 1,000 pounds out there, and he took a pH in the, 7.3 to 7.5 range, all the way down to 5.1 by the middle of the summer. So he was excited about that. He was just thrilled about it. And Brand's like, yeah, he's excited. This is my ground. Now we got to raise the pH back up. Yeah, you do. But you know what? It's a whole lot easier to raise pH up than to get pH to go down. So Jonathan, you've taken the first step, got your drainage in. Now you might want to do some experimenting with the elemental sulfur. Try some rates. Give it a year or even two just to play out and see what happens. But if I was you, I'd take at least one or two spots, pull a soil sample before you put the elemental sulfur, and then pull one, you know, a few months after, maybe midsummer, just to see where you're at, and then pull another test in the fall to see where you're at, and try and learn what that elemental sulfur does on your farm. Now, in terms of finding a good source of elemental sulfur, there's a lot of different sources out there. And we actually brought in several different sources to our farm this summer, just samples to see how water soluble it was and how fine the particles were. Just like with lime, we're looking for really fine particles because that's going to provide more surface area with the product to make more change out in your field quickly. So there are some sources of elemental sulfur. When we were talking with Neil Kinsey, who's a soil fertility expert, he said there's some sources that it may take 5 years for it to fully break down in your soil. Well, you don't have 5 years. You want something to happen soon. So make sure you get a good source of elemental sulfur. And then the last question you had, is this a one and done application, or can I expect the pH to creep back up? If so, how often will we have to reapply? We're sure hoping that we fix the problem. Now, if we haven't found out what the problem is, like for example, say that you're putting irrigation water out there and the irrigation water is a 9 pH and it's got a lot of sodium in there. Yeah, if we're going to continue to apply that water and not treat it, well, then we're going to have to continue putting on elemental sulfur or using other techniques to lower soil pH. So, yeah, assuming that drainage was your problem, you've got the drainage fixed, it could definitely be a one-and-done type application. Hey, thanks a lot for the question, Jonathan. I hope that answers it, and we may have an agronomist follow up with you a little bit more too, just to get some more questions answered and see what else can be done. All right, got another question. This one comes from Rob, and I don't see what state Rob's from. He said, "I'm conflicted on how I should be crediting residual nitrogen for corn following soybeans." Oh, Rob, I wish my brother was here. He would love your question. So my first question is, when looking at a soil test, should I add together subsoil nitrogen, meaning 8 to 30 inches deep, and the shallow nitrogen that's left in the soil at 0 to 8 inches deep? My CECs are mostly 23 to 30. I got heavy ground, and I got 3.5% organic matter on average. Hey, that's awesome. That's awesome. You got a lot of holding capacity there. So now, in the past, following a soybean crop, I've been taught to use a legume credit of up to 30 to 40 pounds per acre of N. I've noticed that you've never mentioned that on your show, though, for calculating nitrogen needs for your corn. So what's the question here? Well, so my second question, should I be considering organic matter release instead of that legume credit, or should I use both? Hey, Rob, you're right on. We don't talk about a legume credit for nitrogen because there isn't one. There's no set number. We've seen 40 bushel soybeans leave no nitrogen, we've seen them leave 100 pounds of nitrogen. It just varies. So we definitely look at your organic matter and we try to figure what you're going to get for mineralization out of the organic matter. Typically, in our part of the world, roughly 20 pounds of nitrogen for each 1% of organic matter. So for you, that would be roughly 70 pounds of N that you're going to get, plus whatever you see show up on your test. And if you're going to credit the deep stuff, if you think you can legitimately get it, I would add that to your recommendation as well. We'll be right back with more of your questions after this.
In farming, there's a lot of variables out of our control. Don't let fertility be one of them. Let the experts at AgroLiquid move you closer to your bullseye. It's true. AgroLiquid fertilizers are formulated to keep nutrients available to your crop, and they have unmatched compatibility with other nutrients and crop protection products, which makes application more efficient than ever. But we also have the best people in the field, ready to talk about your operation, your goals. Go to agroliquid.com to move you closer to your target.
For over a year, I've been butchering the scripts for the Farmer's Edge ads on my podcast. But hey, it's not my fault. Honestly, they offer too much stuff. On-farm weather stations, that little plastic data transfer thingy they shove in your tractor's port, daily satellite imagery, their integrated farm management software, soil sampling, variable rate technology, it goes on and on and on. And they expect me to do that in one ad. That's why I just say, Farmer's Edge. It's a company developed by an agronomist to help make you a better farmer.
Clean fields and higher yields start with a strong battle plan. For soybean growers, there's no stronger ally than Sonic herbicide. When applied pre-emerge, Sonic has proven to defeat yield robbers like water hemp, mare's tail, and giant ragweed. With long-lasting residual control, it keeps fighting to defend your field from invaders. Visit battleweeds.com to plan your attack against weeds. Always read and follow label directions.
Sir, yes, sir!
You need a powerful herbicide to fight the war on weeds. Vellum is Rotam North America's mesotrione herbicide, and it fights against the annual broadleaf weeds attacking your cornfields. Winning this battle means higher yields, lower cost to you, and maximized profitability. For long-lasting residual weed control, check out Evinco Vilify and our newest mix, Rixa. For application, flexibility, and season-long control, that's Evinco Vilify and Rixa, powered by Vellum. For more information, visit vellumherbicide.com. That's B-E-L-L-U-M herbicide.com.
What do you think of when you hear Palmer Amaranth or water hemp? If you use Fierce herbicide in your soybean field, you don't have to think about them at all. With two effective modes of action and up to 8 weeks of residual control, Fierce takes on even the toughest weeds like water hemp and Palmer Amaranth. Take control of your soybean field and get rewarded with Roundup Ready Plus when you choose the proven power of Fierce herbicide. Talk to your local retailer today to put Fierce to work in your fields. Always read and follow label directions.
Customer service goes a long way when trying something new. Ryan Shaw from Michigan shares how Soil Warrior helped him transition to strip tillage in his operation.
The Soil Warrior guys, they are amazing to work with. They made this jump in this transition extremely painless. One question that I get all the time is, how is the service and everything? And I said, well, actually, I get better service from them than I typically do my dealers uptown. They're just amazing.
More info at SoilWarrior.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio, broadcasting from the Morton Studio today. Taking your calls and questions all throughout the show at 844-44-AG-PHD, or you can send us an email, radio@agphd.com. Hey, before the break, we were talking about Rob's question about, is there a legume credit for nitrogen when you're rotating corn and soybeans? Should you just consider, hey, there's going to be some soybeans left from, or some nitrogen left from the soybeans? We've seen soil tests where there's virtually no nitrogen left after an average soybean crop. We've seen virtually no nitrogen left after a high-yielding soybean crop. And then, of course, we've seen the opposite, where there's been plenty of nitrogen left. The best thing you can do is soil test. Take a look at what you've got. Now, Rob asked the question, what about a 0 to 8-inch test and an 8 to 30-inch test? Do you give full credit for all of that nitrogen? And Rob, what we would do, the 0 to 8 for sure, we'd give 100% credit to. The 8 to 30-inch test is a little bit tricky because what if all that nitrogen is down at 30 inches deep? You're probably not going to get at least some of that nitrogen. Now, if you said, well, it's an 8 to 30 inch test, but almost all of it's in the 8 to 12 inch profile, well, I'd say, well, yeah, you're going to get, I would say, 100% of that 8 to 12 inch stuff in most cases, especially in heavier soils like you've got. So it kind of depends on where it's at. So 8 to 30 inches, that's a long ways. I'd maybe break that up at least in a couple of spots and just look at it maybe 8 to 16, 16 to 24, 24 to 32, something like that, just so you can see where it's at. And judge by that. So I don't know what you'd give in that 8 to 30 inch test. Maybe you'd only give 50% credit for that. Maybe you'd give 100%. You just have to see depending on where you're at. And then certainly mineralization of your organic matter. You've got 3.5% organic matter. I'd give 100% credit for 20 pounds going into the year. And then during the year, you can always adjust that plan. So if you say, you know what, I may need a little bit more because we've been cloudy and cool all year, I'm probably not getting my normal mineralization rate. Or maybe you'd say, wow, we've had plenty of moisture, we've been very warm, we've got great growing conditions all throughout the season. I might get 30 pounds of nitrogen per 1% of organic matter and mineralization too. So make sure you look at those three factors and just adjust as the year goes on, if depending on what kind of weather you're getting. Again, thanks for the question, Rob. All right, next question comes from Wes. And he said, I'm looking over some of my soil tests. I ran them through Midwest Labs. I'm going to be adding micros to my fertility plan so that I can build the micros to the recommended levels. I'm way high in iron, according to the 20 to 40 parts per million that you would say we have to have at least 20 to 40. I'm at 175. And my average samples are showing 175 parts per million of iron, 19 parts per million of sulfur, 6/10 of a part per million of zinc, 4 parts per million manganese, 1.4 parts per million of copper, and 0.3 parts per million of boron. With these kinds of results, I've got three general questions. Of the micros, is there a particular philosophy of priority? In other words, which micros should I focus on first? Wow, that's an interesting question. You know, number one, we don't get a lot of guys that are totally focused on the micros, although that number of farmers that are focused on micros is really growing. And number two, it's often not, well, hey, I'm only going to put one micro out there. I know I need to put several of them. And in this case, you definitely do, Wes, because with sulfur, we'd like to see at least 20 or 25 parts per million out there. That would give us 40 or 50 pounds of sulfur in the soil profile that we've got to try and grab, because a lot of the crops that we're raising, depending on which crop you're raising, but you may need 20 to 30 pounds of sulfur, and the chances of getting 100% of what's in the soil are slim. So we want to make sure we've got enough. With zinc, one of the things that we'll look at with zinc, we'd like to see, you know, significantly higher than 0.6 parts per million, but we kind of base it off what our phosphorus levels are. So let's say, for example, that you've got 30 parts per million of phosphorus. Well, we'd say we want to have at least 3 parts per million of zinc. We'd like that to be at least at a 10 to 1 ratio. So if you've got higher phos, it can inhibit the uptake of zinc. And if you have excessively high zinc, it can inhibit the uptake of phosphorus. Those two numbers kind of work against each other that way. So they need to be in balance. With manganese, we'd like that to be at least 20 to 40 parts per million, and we'd like it to be less than the parts per million of iron. Well, this is no problem. You have 175 parts per million of iron and only 4 parts per million of manganese. One of the challenges we've had, and I don't have your soil test in front of me, Wes, but one of the things we've had with manganese is we don't have very many parts per million available, and we do believe the DTPA testing that Midwest Labs is doing is showing us what's available for this year's crop. We don't have good availability if we don't have low soil pH. If we've got a low 6s soil pH, our manganese availability goes up. So I'm going to guess when I see only 4 parts per million of manganese that you've got a pH at 7 or maybe even higher. So that would be good information for me to have. So for me, the zinc, go ahead and put some zinc sulfate on. I'm great with that. The manganese, I would be looking at a manganese chelate, and I would put that in a 2x2 or real close to the row so we know that we can get a hold of that. And I may even consider doing some foliar later, but I think your best bang for your buck is generally getting something out with the planter. Your iron is fine. At 175 parts per million, I'm not worried about that being too high. I'm okay with that. I'm not going to focus on that one. But copper at 1.4 parts per million, That's not terrible. We're getting our copper levels up to 2, but in relation to everything else, they're a bigger fish to fry. The boron at 0.3 parts per million is definitely one of those fish. I would get some boron out there. Now, we've been putting pretty good rates of 3 pounds of elemental boron out there, so a pretty large rate of boron broadcast in some heavier soils in our part of the country, and we've had good luck with that, and we've seen many of the higher-yielding farmers that we've been talking to that are getting really high-yielding corn, 300 bushel plus, we're hearing those guys say, wow, everything we learned about boron was wrong. We can put a lot more out there than what we've been told. And everybody's nervous because they know if you overdo boron and get too much of it too close to the plants, you can hurt things. So play with that one cautiously, but I would try to get that at least up over a part per million to begin with and start from there and build it. So yeah, I would look at boron, manganese, and zinc as the real priorities here. And then of course you need some sulfur, but that's not really a micronutrient. In converting the parts per million on these reports, Wes's question, do I take the parts per million times 2 to get elemental pounds to add? Although I'm not sure what the Ag PhD Soils app would calculate out to. Okay, so yeah, when you're figuring these out, you can take parts per million times 2 if you're looking at a 6-inch soil test to tell you how many pounds of zinc or manganese or boron that you've got out there, and then I would go from there. So yeah, if you want to get up to, let's just say, for example, you're trying to get up to 3 pounds of zinc out in your soil, then you've only got 1.2 pounds out there, or I'm sorry, 3 parts per million, that'd be 6 pounds. You've got 1.2 pounds out there now at 0.6 parts per million times 2 is 1.2. So to get up to 6, you're going to need 4.8 pounds of actual zinc. And if you're using a 35% zinc sulfate, well, that's roughly 15 pounds. So you can just run the calculation yourself based on whatever form of these nutrients you're putting out there. Last question he had, he said, reviewing Mulder's chart with the iron running 150 to up to 215, should I be concerned with antagonism around phosphorus? It looks like zinc may help alleviate that. Yeah, you want to get that zinc level up, and I think you'll be in good shape. And Wes also adds a comment, hope Arizona treated you well, and thanks for what you're doing. Hey, thanks, Wes. We really appreciate that. I know you've sent a number of questions in, and we're more than happy to take them. Really appreciate your support. All right. Let's see. Got time for one more. And this one is from Mike. He said, you talk about manure and you talk about compost. What if I was going to apply both? You know what, Mike? That would be totally fine. If you were going to apply some compost, which has a little slower release of nutrients, and then you were going to apply some manure, which has a higher percentage of those nutrients available first year, yeah, you could absolutely do that. I'd have no issue with that. You know, we see many farmers using one or the other just because they're only going to go over the field once. But if you were going to spread a couple of different times across your field and you felt you could do it without creating a bunch of compaction, I wouldn't see any issue in doing that. Hey, thanks a lot for the question, Mike. Really appreciate it. Well, I've been having fun this winter so far. I've been doing a little bit of traveling around, doing some Ag PhD winter workshops. If you'd like to attend one, we'd love to see you there. You can just go to agphd.com and click on the events tab for a full list of where Brian and I will be this winter. Thanks for all your questions today. Really appreciate it. And thanks for listening. And be sure to join us again each weekday for more Ag PhD Radio. Now, stay tuned for Rob Sharkey and Shark Farmer Radio.